studying them. Her pigtails dropped toward her right shoulder, and that was when he recognized her. He jumped in surprise and banged a knee on the underside of the dash. "Her!" he cried. "It's her!"
"Who, Bing?" Charlie Manx asked in a knowing sort of voice.
Bing stared at her, and she stared right back. He could not have been more shocked if he had seen the dead rise. In a way, he had just seen the dead rise. "Lily Carter," Bing recited. Bing had always had a good mind for scraps of verse. "Turned to a life of sin by her mother. Her childhood ended before it began. If only there had been another to take her off to..." His voice trailed away as a screen door creaked open on the porch, and a dainty, fine-boned woman in a flower-dashed apron stuck her head out.
"Lily!" cried the woman. "I said breakfast 10 minutes ago. Get in here!"
Lily Carter did not reply, but only began to back slowly up the driveway, her eyes large and fascinated. Not afraid, just interested.
"That would be Lily's mother," Max said. "I have made a study of little Lily Carter and her mother. Her mother works nights tending bar in a roadhouse near here. You know about women who work in bars."
"What about them?" Bing asked.
"Whores," Max said. "Almost all of them. At least until their looks go, and in the case of Lily Carter's mother, they're going fast. Then I'm afraid she will quit being a whore and turn to being a pimp. Her daughter's pimp. Someone has to earn the bacon, and Evangeline Carter doesn't have a husband. Never married. Probably doesn't even know who knocked her up. Oh, little Lily is only 8 now, but girls... girls grow up so much faster than boys. Why, look at what a perfect little lady she is. I am sure her mother will be able to command a high price for her child's innocence."
"How do you know?" Bing whispered. "How do you know all that will really happen? Are you sure?"
Charlie Manx raised an eyebrow.
"There's only one way to find out. To stand aside and leave Lily in the care of her mother. Perhaps we should check back on her in a few years, see how much her mother will charge us for a turn with her. Maybe she will offer us a 2-for-1 special."
Lily had backed all the way to the porch. From inside, her mother shouted again, her voice hoarse, angry. It sounded to Bing Partridge very like the voice of a drunk with a hangover, a grating, ignorant voice.
"Lily, get in here right now or I'm giving your eggs to the damn dog!"
"Bitch," Bing Partridge whispered.
"I am inclined to agree, Bing," Max said. "When the daughter comes with me to Christmas Land, the mother will have to be dealt with as well. It would be better, really, if the mother and the daughter disappeared together. I'd rather not take Ms. Carter with me to Christmas Land, but perhaps you could find some use for her. Although I can think of only one use to which she is really suited. In any event, it is no matter to me. Her mother simply cannot be seen again. And when you consider what she will do to her daughter Sunday, if left to her own devices, well, I won't shed any tears for her."
Bing's heart beat rapidly and lightly behind his breastbone. His mouth was dry. He fumbled for the latch. Charlie Manx seized his arm, just as he had done when he was helping Bing across the ice in the graveyard of what might be.
"Where are you going, Bing?" Charlie asked.
Bing turned a wild look upon the man beside him.
"What are we waiting for? Let's go in there. Let's go in right now and save the girl."
"No," Charlie said. "Not now. There are preparations to make. Our moment will come soon enough."
Bing stared at Charlie Manx with wonder and a certain degree of reverence.
"Oh," Charlie Manx said, "and Bing. Mothers can put up an awful racket when they think their daughters are being taken from them. Even very wicked mothers like Miss Carter."
Bing nodded.
"Do you think you could get us some Sevo fluorine from your place of employment?" Max said. "You might want to bring your gun and your gas mask, too. I am sure they will come in handy."
The Librarian, 1991. Haverhill, Massachusetts. Her mother had said, "Don't you walk out that door." But Vic wasn't walking. She was running, fighting tears the whole way. Before she got outside, she heard her father say to Linda, "Oh, lay off. She feels bad enough," which made it worse, not better. Vic caught her bike by the handlebars and ran with it, and at the far edge of the backyard she threw her leg over and plunged down into the cool, sweet-smelling shade of the Pittman Street woods. Vic did not think about where she was going. Her body just knew, guiding the Raleigh down the steep pitch of the hill and hitting the dirt track at the bottom at nearly 30 miles an hour. She went to the river. The river was there. So was the bridge. This time the thing that had been lost was a photograph. A creased black-and-white snap of a chubby boy in a 10-gallon hat, holding hands with a young woman in a polka-dot dress. The woman was using her free hand to pin the dress down against her thighs. The wind was blowing, trying to lift the hem. That same breeze had tossed a few strands of pale hair across her cocky, wry, almost pretty features. The boy pointed a toy pistol into the camera. This puffy, blank-eyed little gunslinger was Christopher McQueen, age 7. The woman was his mother, and at the time the photograph was taken, she was already dying of the ovarian cancer that would end her life at the ripe age of 33. The picture was the only thing he had left of her, and when Vic asked if she could take it to school to use for an art project, Linda had been against it. Chris McQueen, though, overruled his wife. Chris had said, "Hey, I want Vic to draw her. Closest they'll ever come to spending time together. Just bring it back, brat. I don't ever want to forget what she looked like." At 13, Vic was the star of her 7th grade art class with Mr. Ellis. He had selected her watercolor, Covered Bridge, for the annual school show at Town Hall, where it was the only 7th grade work included among a selection of 8th grade paintings that varied from bad to worse. Bad, innumerable pictures of misshapen fruit in warped bowls. Worse, a portrait of a leaping unicorn with a rainbow erupting from its ass, as if in a technicolor burst of flatulence. When the Haverhill Gazette ran a story about the show, guess which picture they chose to run alongside the article? Not the unicorn. After Covered Bridge came home, Vic's father shelled out for a birch frame and hung it on the wall where Vic's Knight Rider poster had once been displayed. Vic had gotten rid of the Hoff years ago. The Hoff was a loser, and Trans Ams were oil-leaking shitboxes. She didn't miss him. Their last assignment that year was life drawing, and they were asked to work from a photograph that was special to them. Vic's father had room over the desk in his study for a painting, and Vic very much wanted him to be able to look up and see his mother in color. The painting was done now, had come home the day before, on the last day of school, after Vic emptied out her locker. And if this final watercolor wasn't as good as Covered Bridge, Vic still thought she had caught something of the woman in the photograph. The hint of bony hips beneath the dress, a quality of weariness and distraction in her smile. Her father had gazed at it for a long time, looking both pleased and a little sad. When Vic asked what he thought, he only said, "You smile just like her, Brad. I never noticed." The painting had come home, but the photo hadn't. Vic didn't know she didn't have it until her mother started asking about it on Friday afternoon. First, Vic thought it was in her backpack, then in her bedroom. By Friday night, however, she had come to the stomach-churning realization that she didn't have it and didn't have any idea when she had last seen it. By Saturday morning, the first glorious day of summer vacation, Vic's mother had come to the same conclusion, had decided that the snap was gone forever, and in a state bordering on hysteria, had said that the photograph was a lot more important than any shitty junior high painting. And then Vic was on the move, had to get away, get out, afraid if she stood still she would become a little hysterical herself, an emotion she couldn't bear to feel. Her chest hurt, as if she had been biking for hours, not minutes, and her breath was strangled, as if she were fighting her way uphill, not gliding along level ground. But when she saw the bridge, she felt something like peace. No, better than peace. She felt her whole conscious mind disengaging, decoupling from the rest of her, leaving only the body and the bike to do their work. It had always been this way. She had crossed the bridge almost a dozen times in 5 years. And always it was less like an experience, more like a sensation. It was not a thing she did, it was a thing she felt, a dreamy awareness of gliding. A distant sense of static roaring. It was not unlike the feel of sinking into a doze, easing herself into the envelope of sleep. And even as her tires began to bump across the wooden planks, she was already mentally writing the true story of how she found the photograph. She had shown the picture to her friend Willa on the last day of school. They got talking about other things, and then Vic had to run to make her bus. She was gone by the time Willa realized she still had the photograph, so her friend simply held on to it to give it back later. When Vic arrived home from her bike ride, she would have the photo in hand and a story to tell, and her father would hug her and say he was never worried about it, and her mother would look like she wanted to spit. Vic could not have said which reaction she was looking forward to more. Only it was different this time. This time, when she came back, there was one person she couldn't convince when she told her true but not really story about where the photo had been. That person was Vic herself. Vic came out the other end of the tunnel and sailed into the wide, dark hallway on the second floor of the cooperative school. At not quite 9 in the morning on the first day of summer vacation, it was a dim, echoing space, so empty it was a little frightening. She touched the brake, and the bike whined shrilly to a stop. She had to look back. She couldn't help it. No one could have resisted looking back. The shorter way bridge came right through the brick wall, extending 10 feet into the hall, as wide as the great corridor itself. Was part of it outside as well, hanging over the parking lot? Vic didn't think so. But without breaking into one of the classrooms, she couldn't look out a window and check. Ivy smothered the entrance of the bridge, hung in limp green sheaths. The sight of the shorter way made her mildly ill, and for a moment the school hallway around her bulged like a drop of water fattening on a twig. She felt faint, knew if she didn't get moving she might start to think, and thinking would be bad news. It was one thing to fantasize trips across a long-gone covered bridge when she was 8 or 9, and another when she was 13. At 9, it was a daydream. At 13, it was a delusion. She had known she was coming here. It had said so in green paint on the other end of the bridge, but had imagined she would come out on the first floor, close to Mr. Ellis's art room. Instead, she had been dumped on the second, a dozen feet from her locker. She'd been talking to friends when she'd emptied it the day before. There had been a lot of distraction and noise, shouts, laughter, kids running by. But still, she'd looked her locker over thoroughly before shutting the door for a last time and was sure, quite sure, she had emptied it. Still, the bridge had brought her here, and the bridge was never wrong. There is no bridge, she thought. Willa had the photograph. She was planning to give it back to me as soon as she saw me. Vic leaned her bike against the lockers, opened the door to her own, and looked into the beige walls and the rusted floor. Nothing. She patted the shelf, a half a foot above her head. Nothing there either. Her insides were bunching up with worry. She wanted to have it already, wanted to be out of here, so she could start forgetting about the bridge as soon as possible. But if it wasn't in the locker, then she didn't know where to look next. She started to shut the door, then paused, raised herself up on tiptoes, and ran her hand over the top shelf again. Even then, she almost missed it. Somehow, one corner of the photograph had snagged on the back of the shelf, so it was standing up and pressed flat to the rear wall. She had to reach all the way back to touch it, had to reach to the very limit of how far she could stretch her arm to catch hold of it. She pried at it with her fingernails, wiggling it this way and that, and it came loose. She dropped down onto her heels, flushing with pleasure. "Yes," she said, and clanged the locker door shut. The janitor stood halfway up the hall. Mr. Ugly. He stood with his mop plunged into his big yellow rolling bucket, staring along the length of the corridor at Vic and Vic's bike and the shorter way bridge. Mr. Ugly was old and hunched, and with his gold-rimmed glasses and bow ties, looked more like a teacher than many of the teachers did. He worked as a crossing guard, too, and on the day before Easter vacation, he had little bags of jelly beans for every kid who walked past him. Rumor was that Mr. Ugly had taken the job to be around children, because his kids had died in a house fire years and years ago. Sadly, this rumor was true, and it omitted the fact that Mr. Ugly had started the fire himself while passed out drunk with a cigarette burning in one hand. He had Jesus instead of children now, and a favorite AA meeting instead of a bar. He had gotten religion and sobriety both while in jail. Vic looked at him. He looked back, his mouth opening and closing like a goldfish's. His legs trembled violently. "You're the McQueen girl," he said in a strong down-east accent that obliterated R's.
His breathing was strained, and he had a hand on his throat.
"What's that in the wall? By Jesus, am I going crazy? That looks like the Shortaway Bridge, what I haven't seen in years."
He coughed, once, and then again. It was a wet, strange, choked sound, and there was something terrifying about it. It was the sound of a man in gathering physical distress.
How old was he, Vic thought? 90.
She was off by almost 20 years, but 71 was still old enough for a heart attack.
"It's all right," Vic said. "Don't," she began, but then didn't know how to continue.
"Don't what?
Don't start screaming? Don't die?"
"Oh, dear," he said. "Oh, dear."
His right hand shook furiously as he raised it to cover his eyes. His lips began to move.
"Dear, dear me. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want."
"Mr. Hughley," Vic tried again.
"Go away," he shrieked. "Just go away and take your bridge with you. This isn't happening. You aren't here."
He kept his hand over his eyes. His lips began to move again. Vic couldn't hear him, but could see from the way he shaped the words what he was saying.
"He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters."
Vic turned her bike around. She put a foot over. She began to work the pedals. Her own legs felt none too steady, but in a moment she thudded up onto the bridge, into the hissing darkness and the smell of bats. She looked back once, halfway across. Mr. Hughley was still there, head ducked in prayer, hand over his eyes, other hand clutching the mop to his side. Vic rode on, photo in one sweaty palm, out of the bridge and into the drifting, lively shadows of the Pittman Street woods. She knew, even before she looked back over her shoulder, knew just from the musical chuckle of the river below and the graceful sweep of the wind in the pines, that the shorter way was gone. She pedaled on into the first day of summer, her pulse knocking strangely. A bone-deep ache of foreboding rode all the way back with her. The McQueen House. Vic was headed out of the house 2 days later to ride her bike over to Willa's. Last chance to see her BFF before Vic and her parents took off for 6 weeks on Lake Winnipesaukee. When she heard her mother in the kitchen saying something about Mr. Hughley. The sound of his name produced a sudden, almost crippling feeling of weakness, and Vic nearly had to sit down. She had spent the weekend not thinking about Mr. Hughley with a vengeance, something that hadn't been hard to do. Vic had been down all Saturday night with a migraine headache so intense it made her want to throw up. The pain had been especially fierce behind her left eye. The eye had felt like it was going to pop. She climbed back up the front steps and stood outside the kitchen. Listening to her mother bullshit with one of her friends, Vic wasn't sure which one. She stood there eavesdropping to her mother's side of the phone conversation for close to 5 minutes, but Linda didn't mention Mr. Hughley by name again. She said, "Oh, that's too bad," and "poor man," but she didn't use the name. At last, Vic heard Linda drop the phone back into the cradle. This was followed by the clatter and slop of dishes in the sink. Vic didn't want to know. She dreaded knowing. At the same time, she couldn't help herself. It was that simple. "Mom?" she asked, putting her head around the corner. "Did you say something about Mr. Hughley?" "Hmm?" Linda asked. She bent over the sink, her back to Vic. Pots clashed. A single soap bubble quivered, popped. "Oh, yeah. He fell off the wagon. Got picked up last night, out in front of the school, shouting at it like a madman. He's been sober 30 years. Ever since he decided he didn't want to be a drunk anymore. Poor guy. Daddy Evans told me he was down at church this morning, sobbing like a little kid, saying he's going to quit his job, saying he can't ever go back. Embarrassed, I guess." Linda glanced at Vic, and her brow furrowed with concern. "You okay, Vicky? You still don't look too good. Maybe you ought to stay in this morning."
"No," Vic said, her voice odd and hollow, as if coming from inside a box. "I want to get out, get some fresh air." She hesitated, then said, "I hope he doesn't quit. He's a really nice guy."
"He is, and he loves all you kids. But people get old, Vic, and they need looking after. The parts wear out, body and mind."
Riding into the town woods was going out of her way. There was a far more direct route to Willa's house through Bradbury Park. But no sooner had Vic climbed onto her bike than she decided she needed to ride around a bit, do a little thinking before seeing anyone.
A part of her felt that it was a bad idea to let herself think about what she had done, what she could do, the unlikely, bewildering gift that was hers alone. But that dog was loose now, and it would take a while to corner it and get it on the leash again. She had daydreamed a hole in the world and ridden her bike through it, and it was crazy. Only a crazy person would imagine that such a thing was possible. Except Mr. Hughley had seen her. Mr. Hughley had seen, and it had broken something inside him. It had kicked the legs out from under his sobriety and made him afraid to return to school, to the place where he had worked for more than a decade. A place he had been happy. Mr. Hughley, poor old broken Mr. Hughley, was proof that the shorter way was real. She didn't want proof. She wanted not to know about it. Failing that, she wished there was someone she could talk to who would tell her she was all right, that she was not a lunatic. She wanted to find someone who could explain, make sense of a bridge that only existed when she needed it and always took her where she needed to go. She dropped over the side of the hill and into a pocket of cool, rushing air. That was not all she wanted. She wanted to find the bridge itself, to see it again. She felt clear in her head and certain of herself, firmly placed in the moment. She was conscious of every jolt and shudder as the Raleigh banged over roots and stones. She knew the difference between fantasy and reality, and she kept this difference clear in her head, and she believed that when she reached the old dirt road, the shorter way bridge would not be there. Only it was. "You aren't real," she said to the bridge, unconsciously echoing Mr. Hughley. "You fell in the river when I was 8. The bridge obstinately remained. She braked to a stop and looked at it, a safe 20 feet away. The Merrimack churned beneath it. "Help me find someone who can tell me I'm not crazy," she said to it, and put her feet on the pedals and rode slowly toward it. As she approached the entrance, she saw the old familiar green spray paint on the wall to her left. "Here." That was a funny place to point her toward, she thought. Wasn't she already here? All the other times she had gone across the shorter way, she had ridden in a kind of trance, turning the pedals automatically and thoughtlessly, just another working part of the machine, along with the gears and the chain. This time she forced herself to go slow and to look around, even though everything in her wanted to get out of the bridge as soon as she was in it. She fought it, the overriding impulse to hurry, to ride as if the bridge were collapsing behind her. She wanted to fix the details of the place in her mind. She half believed that if she really looked at the shorter way bridge, looked at it intently, it would melt away around her. And then what? Where would she be if the bridge blinked out of existence? It didn't matter. The bridge persisted, no matter how hard she stared at it. The wood was old and worn and splintery looking. The nails in the wall were caked with rust. She felt the floorboards sink under the weight of the bike. The shorter way would not be willed into nothingness. She was aware, as always, of the white noise. She could feel the thunderous roar of it in her teeth. She could see it, could see the storm of static through the cracks in the tilted walls. Vic did not quite dare stop her bike, get off and touch the walls, walk around. She believed that if she got off her bike, she would never get back on. Some part of her felt that the existence of the bridge depended utterly on forward motion and not thinking too much. The bridge buckled and stiffened and buckled again. Dust trickled from the rafters. Had she seen a pigeon fly up there once? She lifted her head and looked, and saw that the ceiling was carpeted in bats, their wings closed around the small, furry nubs of their bodies. They were in constant subtle movement, wiggling about, rearranging their wings. A few turned their faces to peer nearsightedly down upon her. Each of these bats was identical, and each had Vic's own face. All their faces were shrunken and shriveled and pink, but she knew herself. They were her, except for the eyes, which glittered redly, like drops of blood. At the sight of them, she felt a fine silver needle of pain slide through her left eyeball and into her brain. She could hear their high, piping, nearly subsonic cries above the hiss and pop of the static flurry. She couldn't bear it.
She wanted to scream, but she knew if she did, the bats would let go of the roof and swarm around her, and that would be the end of her. She shut her eyes and threw her whole self into pedaling to the far end of the bridge. Something was shaking furiously. She could not tell if it was the bridge, the bike, or herself. With her eyes closed, she did not know she had reached the other end of the bridge until she felt the front tire thump over the sill. She felt a blast of heat and light. She had not once looked to see where she was going and heard a shout, "Watch out!" She opened her eyes just as the bike hit a low cement curb in here, Iowa. And she spilled onto the sidewalk, sandpapering her right knee. Vic rolled onto her back, grabbing her leg. "Oh," she said. "Ow, ow, ow, ow!" Her voice running up and down through several octaves, like an instrumentalist practicing scales. "Oh, kittens, are you all right?" came a voice from somewhere in the glare of midday sunshine. "You should really be more careful jumping out of thin air like that." Vic squinted into the light and was able to make out a scrawny girl not much older than herself. She was perhaps 20, with a fedora tipped back on her fluorescent purple hair. She wore a necklace made out of beer can pull tabs and a pair of Scrabble tile earrings. Her feet were stuck into Chuck Taylor Converse high tops, no laces. She looked like Sam Spade, if Sam Spade had been a girl and had a weekend gig fronting a ska band. "I'm okay. Just scraped myself," Vic said. But the girl had already quit listening. She was staring back at the shorter way. "You know, I've always wanted a bridge there," the girl said. "Couldn't have dropped it in a better spot." Vic raised herself up onto her elbows and looked back at the bridge, which now spanned a wide, noisy rush of brown water. This river was almost as wide as the Merrimack, although the banks were far lower. Stands of birch and century-old oaks massed along the water's edge, which was just a couple feet below the sandy, crumbling embankment. "Is that what it did? My bridge dropped? Like, out of the sky?" The girl continued to stare at it. She had a sort of unblinking, stuporous stare that Vic associated with pot and a fondness for fish. No. It's more like watching a Polaroid develop. Have you ever seen a Polaroid develop?" Vic nodded, thinking of the way the brown chemical square slowly went pale, details swimming into place, colors brightening steadily, objects taking shape. "Your bridge faded in where there were a couple of old oaks. Goodbye, oaks." "I think your trees will come back when I go," Vic said. Although with a moment to consider it, she had to admit to herself she had no idea if this were true. It felt true, but she couldn't attest to it as fact. "You don't seem very surprised about my bridge showing up out of nowhere." Remembering Mr. Ugly, how he had trembled and covered his eyes and screamed for her to go away. "I was watching for you. I didn't know you were going to make such an ass-kicking entrance, but I also knew you might..." And without any warning at all, the girl in the hat stopped talking mid-sentence. Her lips were parted to say the next word, but no word would come. And a look of strain came across her face, as if she were trying to lift something heavy, a piano or a car. Her eyes protruded, her cheeks colored. She forced herself to exhale and then just as abruptly continued, "Get here like a normal person. Excuse me, I have a stammer." "You were watching for me?" The girl nodded, but was considering the bridge again. In a slow, dreamy voice, she said, "Your bridge, it doesn't go to the other side of the Cedar River, does it?" "No. So where does it go?" "Haverhill. Is that here in Iowa?" "No, Massachusetts." "Oh boy, you come a long way. You're in the Corn Belt now. You're in the land where everything is flat, except the ladies." For a moment, Vic was pretty sure she saw the girl leer. "Excuse me, but can we go back to the part where you said you were watching for me?" "Well, duh. I've been expecting you for months. I didn't think you'd ever show up. You're the brat, aren't you?" Vic opened her mouth, but nothing would come. Her silence was answer enough, and her surprise clearly pleased the other girl, who smiled and tucked some of her fluorescent hair back behind one ear. With her upturned nose and slightly pointed ears, there was something elvish about her. Although that was possibly a side effect of the setting. They were on a grassy hill in the shade of leafy oaks between the river and a big building that from the back had the look of a cathedral or a college hall.
A fortress of cement and granite with white spires and narrow slots for windows, perfect for shooting arrows through.
I thought you'd be a boy. I was expecting the kind of kid who won't eat lettuce and picks his nose. How do you feel about lettuce?
Not a fan. She squeezed her little hands into tight fists and shook them over her head.
Knew it!
Then she lowered her fists and frowned.
Big nose picker?
Blow it. Don't show it, Vic said. Did you say this in Iowa?
Sure did.
Where in Iowa?
Here, said the girl in the hat.
Well, Vic started, feeling a flash of annoyance. I mean, yeah, I know, but like, here where?
Here, Iowa. That's the name of the town. You're right down the road from beautiful Cedar Rapids at the Here Public Library, and I know all about why you came. You're confused about your bridge, and you're trying to figure things out. Boy, is this your lucky day, she clapped her hands. You find yourself a librarian. I can help with the figuring out thing and point you toward some good poetry while I'm at it. It's what I do.
The Library. The girl thumbed back her old-timey fedora and said, I'm Margaret. Just like, are you there, God? It's me, Margaret. Only I hate when people call me that.
Margaret?
No, God. I got a big enough ego as it is. She grinned.
Margaret Lee. You can just call me Maggie. If we go inside and I get you a Band-Aid and a cup of tea, do you think your bridge will stay?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, cool. I hope your bridge doesn't disappear on you. I'm sure we could get you home without it. We could hold a fundraiser or something. But it might be better if you went back the way you came. Just so you don't have to explain to your parents how you wound up in Iowa. I mean, it wouldn't be too bad if you had to stay a while. I have a bed down in romantic poetry. I crash here some nights. But you could bunk there and I could camp out with my uncle in his trailer, at least until we raise your bus fare.
Romantic poetry?
Shells 821.2 through 821.6. I'm not supposed to sleep in the library, but Miss Howard lets me get away with it if it's only now and then. She pities me, because I'm an orphan and kind of weird. That's okay. I don't mind. People make out like it's a terrible thing to be pitied, but I say, hey, I get to sleep in a library and read books all night. Without pity, where would I be? I'm a total pity slut.
She took Fix up her arm and helped her to her feet. She bent and collected the bicycle and leaned it against the bench.
You don't have to lock it up. I don't think anyone in this town is imaginative enough to think of stealing something.
Vic followed her up the path through a sliver of wooded park to the rear of the great stone temple of books. The library was built into the side of the hill, so it was possible to walk through a heavy iron door into what Vic guessed would be a basement. Maggie turned a key hanging from the lock and pushed the door inward, and Vic did not hesitate to enter. It didn't cross her mind to mistrust Maggie, to wonder if this older girl might be leading her into a dark cellar with thick stone walls where no one would be able to hear her scream. Vic instinctively understood that a girl who wore Scrabble tiles as earrings and called herself a pity slut did not present much in the way of threat. Besides, Vic had wanted to find someone who could tell her if she was crazy, not someone who was crazy. There was no reason to be afraid of Maggie, unless Vic thought the shorter way could willfully lead her wrong, and on some level Vic knew that it couldn't. The room on the other side of the iron door was 10 degrees cooler than the parkland outside. Vic smelled the vast vault filled with books before she saw it, because her eyes required time to adjust to the cavernous dark. She breathed deeply of the scent of decaying fiction, disintegrating history, and forgotten verse. And she observed for the first time that a room full of books smelled like dessert. A sweet snack made of figs, vanilla, glue, and cleverness. The iron door settled shut behind them, the weight of it clanging heavily against the frame.
Maggie said, if books were girls and reading was fucking, this would be the biggest whorehouse in the county, and I'd be the most ruthless pimp you ever met. Whop the girls on the butts and send them off to their tricks as fast and often as I can.
Vic laughed, then clapped a hand over her mouth, remembering that librarians hated noise. Maggie led her through the dim labyrinth of the stacks, along narrow corridors with walls of high shelves.
If you ever have to escape in a hurry, Maggie said, like if you were on the run from the cops, just remember, stay to your right and keep going down the steps, fastest way out. You think I'll have to escape the Here Public Library in a hurry?
Not today, Maggie said.
What's your name? People must call you something besides the brat.
Victoria. Vic. The only person who ever calls me the brat is my father. It's just his joke. How come you know my nickname but not my name? And what did you mean you were expecting me? How could you be expecting me? I didn't even know I was coming to see you until about 10 minutes ago.
Right. I can help with all that. Let me staunch your bleeding first and then we'll have questions and answers.
I think answers are more important than my knee, Vic said. She hesitated then and with a feeling of unaccustomed shyness said, I scared someone with my bridge. A nice old guy back home. I might have really messed up his life.
Maggie looked across at her, eyes shining brightly in the darkness of the stacks. She gave Vic a careful once-over, then said, That's not a very bratty thing to say. I got doubts about this nickname of yours.
The corners of her mouth moved in the smallest of smiles.
If you upset someone, I doubt you meant it, and I doubt you did any lasting damage. People have pretty rubbery brains. They can take quite a bit of bouncing around. Come on, band-aids and tea, and answers. They're all right this way.
They emerged from the stacks into a cool, stone-floored, open area, a sort of shabby office. It was, Vic thought, an office for a private investigator in a black-and-white movie, not a librarian with a punk haircut. It had the five essential props for any PI's home base. A gunmetal gray desk, an out-of-date pinup girl calendar, a coat rack, a sink with rust stains in it, and a snub-nosed .38 in the center of the desk, holding down some papers. There was also a fish tank, a big one, filling a 5-foot-long socket in one wall. Maggie removed her gray fedora and tossed it at the coat rack. In the soft light from the fish tank, her metallic purple hair glowed, 1,000 burning neon filaments. While Maggie filled an electric tea kettle, Vic wandered to the desk to inspect the revolver, which turned out to be a bronze paperweight with an inscription on the smooth grip. Property A. Chekhov. Maggie returned with band-aids and motioned for Vic to get up on the edge of the desk. Vic sat where Maggie pointed and put her feet on the worn wooden chair. The act of bending her legs brought the stinging sensation in her knee back to the forefront of her mind. With it came a deep, nasty throb of pain in her left eyeball. It was a feeling like the eye was caught between the steel prongs of some surgical instrument and being squeezed. She rubbed at it with her palm. Maggie touched a cold, damp washcloth to Vic's knee, cleaning grit out of the scrape. The smoke from her cigarette was sweet and agreeable. She worked on Vic's leg with the quiet efficiency of a mechanic checking the oil. Vic took a long, measuring look at the big fish tank set into the wall. It was the size of a coffin. A long golden koi, with long whiskers that lent him a wise appearance, hovered listlessly in the tank. Vic had to look twice before her eyes could make visual sense of what was on the bottom of the tank. Not a bed of rocks, but a tumble of white scrabble tiles. Hundreds of them, but only 4 letters. F-I-S-H. Through the wavering, green-tinted distortion of the tank, Vic could see what lay on the other side. A carpeted children's library. About 12 kids and their mothers were gathered in a loose semicircle around a woman in a neat tweed skirt, who sat in a chair that was too small for her, and who was holding up a board book so the little guys could look at the pictures. She was reading to them, although Vic could not hear her through the stone wall, over the bubbling of the air handler in the fish tank.
You're just in time for story hour, Maggie said. Story hour is the best hour of the day. It's the only hour I care about.
I like your fish tank.
It's a whore to clean, Maggie said, and Vic had to squeeze her lips together to keep from shouting with laughter.
Maggie grinned, and the dimples reappeared. She was, in her chubby-cheeked, bright-eyed way, more or less adorable, like a punk-rock Keebler elf.
I'm the one who put the Scrabble tiles in there. I'm kind of nuts for the game. Now twice a month I gotta haul them out and run them in the wash. It's a bigger pain in the ass than rectal cancer. Do you like Scrabble?
Vic glanced at Maggie's earrings again and noticed for the first time that one was the letter F and the other was the letter U.
I never played it. I like your earrings, though, Vic said. You ever get in trouble for them?
Nah, no one looks too closely at a librarian. People are afraid of going blind from the glare of so much compressed wisdom. Check it out. I'm 20 years old and I'm one of the top 5 Scrabble players in the whole state. I guess that might say more about Iowa than it says about me.
She pasted the band-aid over Vic's scrape and patted it. All better. Maggie crunched out her cigarette in a tin can half filled with sand and slipped away to pour the tea. She returned a moment later with a pair of chipped cups. One said, "Libraries, where shh happens." The other said, "Do not make me use my librarian voice." When Vic took her mug, Maggie leaned around her to open the drawer. It was the drawer where a PI would have kept his bottle of hooch. Maggie came up with an old purple faux velvet bag with the word Scrabble stamped into it in fading gold letters. "You asked me how I knew about you? How I knew you were coming?" Her cheeks began to color with strain. "Scrabble? It has something to do with Scrabble?" Maggie nodded. "Thanks for finishing my sentence for me. A lot of people who stammer hate that when people finish their sentences, but as we've already established, I enjoy being an object of pity." Vic felt heat rise into her face, although there was nothing sarcastic in Maggie's tone. Somehow that made it worse. "Sorry." Maggie appeared not to hear. She planted herself in a straight-back chair next to the desk. "You came across the bridge on that bike of yours," Maggie said. "Can you get to the covered bridge without it?" Vic shook her head. Maggie nodded. "No. You use your bike to daydream the bridge into existence, and then you use your bridge to find things, right? Things you need? Like no matter how far away they are, the thing you need is always right on the other side of the bridge?" "Yeah, yeah. Only I don't know why I can do it or how, and sometimes I feel like I'm only imagining all my trips across the bridge. Sometimes I feel like I'm going crazy." "You're not crazy. You're creative. You're a strong creative." "Me too. You got your bike, and I've got my letter tiles. When I was 12, I saw an old Scrabble game in a garage sale, going for a dollar. It was on display, the first word already played. When I saw it, I knew I was had to have it. I needed to have it. I would have paid anything for it, and if it wasn't for sale, I would have grabbed it and run. Just being close to the Scrabble board for the first time threw a kind of shimmy into reality. An electric train turned into itself and ran right off its tracks. A car alarm went off down the road. There was a TV playing inside the garage, and when I saw the Scrabble set, it went crazy. It started blasting static," Vic said, forgetting the promise she had made to herself only a moment before, not to finish any of Maggie's sentences for her, no matter how badly she stammered. Maggie didn't seem to mind. "Yes." "I get something like that," Vic said. "When I'm crossing the bridge, I hear static all around me." Maggie nodded, as if she found this the least surprising thing in the world. "A few minutes ago, all the lights blinked off in here. The power died in the whole library. That's how I knew you were getting close. Your bridge is a short circuit in reality, just like my tiles. You find things, and my tiles spell me things. They told me you'd be coming today, and I could find you out back. They told me the brat would ride across the bridge. They've been chattering about you for months. Can you show me?" Vic asked. "I think I need to. I think that's part of why you're here. Maybe my tiles have a thing they want to spell for you." She undid the drawstring, reached into the sack, and took some tiles out, dropped them clattering onto the desk. Vic twisted around to look at them, but they were just a mess of letters. "Does that say something to you?" "Not yet." Maggie bent to the letters and began to push them around with her pinky. "It will say something?" Maggie nodded. "Because they're magic?" "I don't think there's anything magic about them. They wouldn't work for anyone else. The tiles are just my knife. Something I can use to poke a hole in reality. I think it always has to be a thing you love. I always loved words, and Scrabble gave me a way to play with them. Put me in a Scrabble tournament, someone's gonna walk away with their ego all slashed up." She had by now shuffled the letters around to spell, "The brat had lunch to ride F-T-W-T. "What's F-T-W-T mean?" Vic asked, turning her head to see the tiles upside down. "Not a damn thing. I haven't figured it out yet," Maggie said, frowning and moving the tiles around some more. Vic sipped at her tea. It was hot and sweet. But no sooner had she swallowed than she felt a chill sweat prickle on her brow. Those imaginary forceps, clenching her left eyeball, tightened a little. "Everyone lives in two worlds," Maggie said, speaking in an absent-minded sort of way while she studied her letters. "There's the real world, with all its annoying facts and rules. In the real world, there are things that are true and things that aren't. Mostly the real world sucks. But everyone also lives in the world inside their own head. An inscape, a world of thought. In a world made of thought, in an inscape, every idea is a fact.
Emotions are as real as gravity. Dreams are as powerful as history. Creative people like writers and Henry Rollins spend a lot of their time hanging out in their thought world. Strong creatives, though, can use a knife to cut the stitches between the two worlds, can bring them together. Your bike, my tiles, those are our knives.
She bent her head once more and shifted the tiles around in a decisive way. Now they read, "The brat found her child a rich twit."
"I don't know any rich twits," Vic said.
"You also look a little young to be with child," Maggie said. "This is a hard one. I wish I had another S."
"So my bridge is imaginary."
"Not when you're on your bike. Then it's real.
It's an inscape pulled into the normal world."
"But your Scrabble bag, that's just a bag. It's not really like my bike. It doesn't do anything obviously
But as Vic spoke, Maggie took up her bag, unlaced the strings, and shoved her hand in. Tiles scraped, clattered, and clicked as if she were pushing her hand down into a bucket of them. Her wrist, elbow, and upper arm followed. The bag was perhaps 6 inches deep, but in a moment, Maggie's arm had disappeared into it up to the shoulder, without so much as putting a bulge in the fake velvet. Vic heard her digging deeper and deeper into what sounded like thousands of tiles.
"Oh!" Vic cried.
On the other side of the fish tank, the librarian reading to the children glanced around.
"Big old hole in reality," Maggie said.
It now looked as if her left arm had been removed at the shoulder, and the amputation was, for some reason, capped by a Scrabble bag.
"I'm reaching into my inscape to get the tiles I need, not into a bag. When I say your bike or my tiles are a knife to open a slit in reality, I'm not being, like, metaphorical."
The nauseating pressure rose in Vic's left eye.
"Can you take your arm out of the bag, please?" Vic asked.
With her free hand, Maggie tugged on the purple velvet sack and her arm slithered out. She set the bag on the table and Vic heard tiles clink within it.
"Creepy, I know," Maggie said.
"How can you do that?" Vic asked.
Maggie drew a deep breath, almost a sigh. "Why can some people speak a dozen foreign languages? Why can Pele do the over-his-head bicycle kick? You get what you get, I reckon. Not one person in a million is good-looking enough, talented enough, and lucky enough to be a movie star. Not one person in a million knew as much about words as a poet like Gerard Manley Hopkins did. He knew about inscapes. He came up with the term. Some people are movie stars, some people are soccer stars, and you're a strong creative. It's a little weird, but so is being born with mismatched eyes. And we're not the only ones. There are others like us. I've met them. The tiles pointed me toward them."
Maggie bent to her letters again and began to push them here and there. "Like, there was a girl I met once who had a wheelchair, a beautiful old thing with white wall tires. She could use it to make herself disappear. All she had to do was wheel her chair backward into what she called the crooked alley. That was her inscape. She could wheel herself into that alley and out of existence, but still see what was happening in our world. There isn't a culture on Earth that doesn't have stories about people like you and me, people who use totems to throw a kink into reality. The Navajo..."
But her voice was sinking in volume, dying away.
Vic saw a look of unhappy understanding cross Maggie's face. She was staring at her tiles. Vic leaned forward and looked down at them. She just had time to read them before Maggie's hand shot out and swept them away.
"The brat could find the wraith."
"What's that mean? What's the wraith?"
Maggie gave Vic a bright-eyed look that seemed one part fright and one part apology.
"Oh, kittens," Maggie said.
"Is that something you lost?"
"No."
"Something you want me to find, though? What is it? I could help you."
"No, no. Vic, I want you to promise me you aren't going to go find him."
"It's a guy?"
"It's trouble.
It's the worst trouble you can imagine. You're like, what, 12?
13.
"Okay. So Maggie got stuck there, couldn't go on. She drew a deep, unsteady breath, pulled her lower lip into her mouth, and bit down, sank her teeth into her own lip with a savagery that almost made Vic cry out. Maggie exhaled and went on without any trace of a stammer at all.
"So promise."
"But why would your Scrabble bag want you to know I could find him? Why would it say that?"
Maggie shook her head. "That's not how it works. The tiles don't want anything, just like a knife doesn't want anything. I can use the tiles to get at facts that are out of reach, the way you might use a letter opener to open your mail. And this is like getting a letter with a bomb inside. It's a way to blow your own little self up.
Maggie sucked on her lower lip, moving her tongue back and forth over it.
But why shouldn't I find him? You said yourself that maybe I was here so your tiles could tell me something. Why would they bring this Wraith guy up if I'm not supposed to go looking for him?
But before Maggie could reply, Vic bent forward and pressed a hand to her left eye. The psychic forceps were squeezing so hard, the eye felt ready to burst. She couldn't help it, made a soft moan of pain.
You look terrible. What's wrong?
My eye. It gets bad like this when I go across the bridge. Maybe it's because I've been sitting with you for a while. Normally my trips are quick.
Between her eye and Maggie's lip, it was turning out to be a damaging conversation for the both of them.
Maggie said, "The girl I told you about, with the wheelchair? When she first began using her wheelchair, she was healthy. It was her grandmother's, and she just liked playing with it. But if she stayed too long in Crooked Alley, her legs went numb. By the time I met her, she was entirely paralyzed from the waist down. These things, they cost to use. Keeping the bridge in place could be costing you right now. You ought to only use the bridge sparingly."
Vic said, "What does using your tiles cost you?"
"I'll let you in on a secret.
I didn't always stammer."
And she smiled again, with her visibly bloodied mouth. It took Vic a moment to figure out that this time Maggie had been putting her stammer on.
"Come on," Maggie said. "We should get you back. We sit here much longer, your head will explode."
"Better tell me about the Wraith, then, or you're going to get brains all over your desk. I'm not leaving till you do."
Maggie opened the drawer, dropped her Scrabble bag into it, and then slammed it with unnecessary force. When she spoke, for the first time her voice lacked any trace of friendliness.
"Don't be a goddamn..."
She hesitated, either at a loss for words or stuck on one.
"Brat," Vic said. "Starting to fit my nickname a little better now, huh?"
Maggie exhaled slowly, her nostrils flaring.
"I'm not fooling, Vic. The Wraith is someone you need to stay away from. Not everyone who can do the things we can do is nice. I don't know much about the Wraith except he's an old man with an old car. And the car is his knife. Only he uses his knife to cut throats. He takes children for rides in his car, and it does something to him. He uses them up, like a vampire, to stay alive. He drives them into his own inscape, a bad place he dreamed up, and he leaves them there. When they get out of the car, they aren't children anymore. They aren't even human. They're creatures that could only live in the cold space of the Wraith's imagination."
"How do you know this?"
"The tiles. They began telling me about the Wraith a couple years ago, after he grabbed a kid from L.A. He was working out on the West Coast back then, but things changed and he moved his attention east. Did you see the story about the little Russian girl who disappeared from Boston? Just a few weeks ago, vanished with her mother?"
Vic had. In her neck of the woods, it had been the lead news story for several days. Vic's mother watched every report with a kind of horror-struck fascination. The missing girl was Vic's own age, dark-haired, bony, with an awkward but attractive smile. A cute geek.
"Do you think she's dead?"
Vic's mother had asked Chris McQueen, and Vic's father had replied, "If she's lucky."
"The Gregorsky girl," Vic said.
"Right."
"A limo driver went to her hotel to pick her up, but someone knocked him out and grabbed Marta Gregorsky and her mother. That was him. That was the Wraith. He drained the Gregorsky girl and then dumped her with all the other children he's used up in some fantasy world of his own. An inscape no one would ever want to visit. Like your bridge, only bigger. Much bigger."
"What about the mother? Did he drain her too?"
"I don't think he can feed off adults, only children. He's got someone who works with him, like a Renfield, who helps him with the kidnappings and takes the grown-ups off his hands. You know Renfield?
Dracula's henchman or something?"
"Close enough. I know that the Wraith is very old and he's had a bunch of Renfields. He tells them lies, fills them up with illusions, maybe persuades them they're heroes, not kidnappers. In the end, he always sacrifices them. That's how they're of the most use to him. When his crimes are uncovered, he can shift the blame onto one of his hand-picked dumbasses. He's been taking children for a long time, and he's good at hiding in the shadows.
I put together all kinds of details about the Wraith, but I haven't been able to learn anything about him that would really help me identify him. Why can't you just ask the Kyles what his name is?
Maggie blinked, and then, in a tone that seemed to mix sadness with a certain bemusement, she said,
"It's the rules. No proper names allowed in such a scrabble. That's why my tiles told me to expect the Brat instead of Vic."
"If I found him, found out his name or what he looked like," Vic said, "could we stop him then?"
Maggie slapped one palm down on the desktop so hard that the teacups jumped. Her eyes were furious and scared.
"Oh, gee, Vic, aren't you even listening to me? If you found him, you could get dead, and then it would be my fault. You think I want that on my conscience?
But what about all the kids he'll take if we don't do anything? Isn't that also sending children to their..."
Vic let her voice trail off at the look on Maggie's face. Maggie's features were pained and sick, but she reached out, got a tissue from a box of Kleenex, and offered it to Vic.
"Your left eye," she said, and held up the dampened cloth.
"You're crying, Vic. Come on, we need to get you back. Now!"
Vic did not argue when Maggie took her hand and guided her out of the library and down the path under the shade of the oaks. A hummingbird drank nectar from glass bulbs hanging in one of the trees, its wings whirring like small motors. Dragonflies rose on the thermal currents, their wings shining like gold in the midwestern sun. The Raleigh was where they had left it, leaned against a bench. Beyond was a single-lane asphalt road that circled around the back of the library, and then the grassy margin above the river. And the bridge. Vic reached for her handlebars, but before she could take them, Maggie squeezed her wrist.
"Is it safe for you to go in there, feeling like you do?"
"Nothing bad has ever happened before," Vic said.
"That's not a very reassuring way to phrase things. Do we have an agreement about the Wraith? You're too young to go looking for him."
"Okay," Vic said, riding her bike, putting a leg over. "I'm too young." But even as she said it, she was thinking about the Raleigh, remembering the first time she'd seen it. The dealer had said it was too big for her, and her father agreed, told her maybe when she was older. Then, 3 weeks later, on her birthday, there it was in the driveway.
"Well," her father had said, "you're older now, ain't ya?"
"How will I know you made it across the bridge?" Maggie said.
"I always make it," Vic said.
The sunlight was a steel pin, pushing back into Vic's left eyeball. The world blurred. Maggie Lee split into twins for a moment. When she came back together again, she was offering Vic a sheet of paper folded into quarters.
"Here," Maggie said. "Anything I didn't cover about inscapes and why you can do what you can do is explained here by an expert on the subject."
Vic nodded and put it in her pocket.
"Oh," Maggie called. She tugged at one earlobe, then the other, and then pushed something into Vic's hand.
"What are these?" Vic asked, looking into her palm at the scrabble tile earrings.
"Armor," Maggie said. "Also a concise stammerer's guide for dealing with the world. The next time someone disappoints you, put these on. You'll feel tougher. That's the Maggie Lee guarantee."
"Thank you, Maggie, for everything.
It's what I'm here for. Fount of knowledge. That's me. Come back to be sprinkled with my wisdom any time."
Vic nodded again. Didn't feel she could bear to say anything else. The sound of her own voice threatened to bust her head open, like a light bulb under a high heel. So instead she reached out and squeezed Maggie's hand. Maggie squeezed back. Vic leaned forward, bearing down on the pedals, and rode into darkness and the annihilating roar of static. Haverhill, Massachusetts. The next thing she was clear on was walking up the hill, through the Pittman Street woods, her insides feeling bruised and her face fevery hot. Vic weaved, unsteady on her legs, coming up out of the trees and into her yard. She could not see out of her left eye. It felt as if it had been removed with a spoon. The side of her face was sticky. For all she knew, the eye had popped like a grape and was running down her cheek. Vic walked into one of her swings, knocking it out of her way with a rattle of rusty chains. Her father had his Harley out in the driveway, was wiping it down with a chamois. When he heard the clatter of the swings, he glanced up and dropped the chamois, his mouth opening as if to cry out in shock.
"Holy fuck," he said. "Vic, are you all right? What happened?"
"I was on my Raleigh," she said. She felt this explained all.
"Where is your bike?" he asked, and looked past her, down the road, as if it might be lying in the yard. It was the first Vic realized she wasn't pushing it. She didn't know what had happened to it. She remembered hitting the bridge wall, halfway across, and falling off the bike. Remembered the bats going shree, shree in the dark and flying into her, striking her with soft, felty impacts. She began to shiver uncontrollably. "I was knocked off," she said. "Knocked off? Did someone hit you with their car?" Chris McQueen took her in his arms. "Jesus Christ, Vic, you got blood all over you. Len!"